Our next case for argument is 21-2172, California Steel Industries versus the United States. Is it Ranstell?
Yes.
Mr. Ranstell, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. This case concerns the Commerce Department's administration of the product exclusion process embedded in the Section 232 steel tariff regime, reflecting the overarching goal of these sections.
Before you get to them,
yes, Your Honor.
The legal issues you want to discuss, can you just tell me what the practical effect of what you want is? Is it just that you want to be able to appeal and file cert petitions?
Yes, Your Honor. No, I'm glad you raised that. So, and this was certainly a focus for the CIT as well. So the practical impact here that we're looking at is, in the first instance, you'll notice that we filed a 28J letter last Friday, and the CIT sort of conceived of this as if the ship has sailed. We're just dealing with past entries, and therefore our interest is sort of lapsed, in a sense. But the settlement in Interpipe shows, if you look at the last page of that 28J submission, that it's dealing with entries as recent as October 2021. So that has a current impact on the market, because these entries could still be sitting in inventory, still be awaiting sale, and that has a current impact on the marketplace, and therefore there's that practical effect. And that's absolutely possible here. In terms of Rule 24, and we think the CIT essentially resolved the question of what relief might be possible prematurely. And in addition to that, there's the sort of question of the administrative determination itself. And so here we have administrative determinations by Commerce that our products are domestically available and therefore should be kept within the protective ambit of the Section 232 tariffs. And so we have those in hand anytime anybody seeks to request an exclusion from the Department of Commerce in the future. It is a regulatory factor. We can take that, place that before the department, and it's something they're going to consider in adjudicating these. And it helps to keep in mind that they're dealing with hundreds of thousands of requests.
I understand. This is a very, at least to my ears, convoluted answer as to why does it matter whether you intervene or just submit amicus briefs?
Oh, that's a great question, Your Honor. So really the crux of the matter is we're dealing with confidential administrative records here, and as amicus, we don't have access to that confidential record. So the crux of sort of the substantive dispute before the
when
court...
When you participate at the administrative level, what do you have access to?
So at the administrative level, we submitted confidential information that we think supports Commerce's determination. So we wouldn't have access to what confidential information, I believe, that the plaintiffs would have submitted. But since Commerce went, you know, in our direction, the critical question for us is the court going to be able to look at that administrative record that we submitted, specifically our confidential information, and find support for the determination that the products are domestically available? And so as amicus, we're sort of on the outside looking in, because there's 800 administrative records, one for each exclusion. Commerce has tried to compile these and provide them to the court, but we can't see what Commerce is telling the court. Look, here's all the information we had in front of us administratively.
What gives you a legal right to do that? Even at the administrative level, all you have is a right to participate. You don't have a right to challenge the other evidence. You don't get to see that evidence, do you?
Your Honor, no.
So you're asking for even more rights than Commerce has given you at the administrative level.
Well, Your Honor, to clarify, we're not asking to challenge the evidence that the plaintiffs have provided. We're asking to ensure that before the court is all of the evidence that we provided administratively, because we think that is what
you
supports Commerce's determination.
You can't submit that in an amicus brief?
I'm sorry?
You can't submit that in an amicus brief?
No, Your Honor, because we can't view the confidential record because we're not parties to the case. So
you
we
can
don't...
view the record, the confidential information you gave them.
We,
if that's all you're concerned about is making sure that the court knows what information you gave Commerce, is there anything that prevents you from supplying that to the court in an amicus brief, even if it's confidential?
Well, we're not currently under the judicial protective order, so that would require a modification to that as non-parties, and I'm not sure if that's even a possibility. But it's
your information.
Yes.
If you want to give it to the court, you can give it to the court.
Certainly, but we don't know that it's not sufficient necessarily that we can provide our information to the court.
It sounds to me like you want an alteration of the statutory structure here to allow you to be a party to the case. And when Congress wants these domestic industries to be a party to the case, like they do in the anti-dumping and countervailing duty proceedings, they specifically provide statutory authority. You don't have any of that, do you?
No, Your Honor. We don't. Section 232 itself, it's a very broad statute. It doesn't spell out this sort
of thing. When Commerce implemented this, if they had wanted to, they could have said, you don't have the right to participate at all, right?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure about that, because the presidential proclamation here...
No, what in 232 would require Commerce to give you the right to participate?
Oh, in Section 232 itself, at this stage for the exclusion process, I'm not sure there's anything in the text of the statute.
Right, so if the President, when it issues some kind of program like this, and he says, look, I'm going to establish these tariffs, Commerce goes set up a program. That doesn't mean you have to be allowed to participate, does it? You would have to look at the text of the presidential proclamation and at what Commerce says.
Right. And as a practical matter...
And so if they give you the right to participate at the administrative level, you get to. And if they don't, you don't.
Yes, Your Honor, we would agree. But we'd also observe that the substantive question that Commerce is forced to decide by the terms of the presidential proclamation...
Let me just ask you this hypothetical quickly. Sure. If all of this were... all the same, the presidential proclamation, the ability of certain parts of the domestic industry to be excluded from this order were there, but you weren't allowed to participate at all. Would that be consistent with 232?
Well, no, it's a great question, because the substantive question Commerce is seeking to determine...
I don't really care whether my question is great or not. I want the answer. Is it consistent with 232 for Commerce to set up a program that excludes your participation altogether?
We would say not necessarily, because Commerce...
What in 232 prohibits it?
Well, 232 delegates the authority to the president to determine the
okay, but
structure.
Don't quibble with me about who is excluding you. Let's just assume the president and Commerce excluded you from participating. You were not allowed to participate in this proceeding whatsoever, even though it was intended in part for your benefit. That's legal, isn't it?
If the president had done so, yes, Your Honor.
So do you think the president gave you a right that extends to participate in legal proceedings at the CIT?
We think the president set up a tariff section that was intended specifically to benefit us, and it directed Commerce to consider specifically whether...
Where in the presidential proclamation does it suggest that you would be given the right to challenge decisions of the administrative agency or participate in their defense at the CIT?
Well, yes, okay. So the presidential proclamation itself does not address appeals of exclusion determinations at all. Not for us, not
for
the other
parties.
What
does it say with regard to your participation?
So it directs Commerce to consider domestic availability. It does not specifically address our participation.
So that doesn't even require you to participate. So the presidential proclamation gives you no legal rights whatsoever.
Well, Your Honor, we wouldn't agree that it gives us no legal rights, because...
Well, it doesn't mention you. It doesn't mention you being allowed to participate at all. So how can that give you legal rights?
Well, it does structure these tariffs for our benefit. And so our understanding would be that if Commerce had...
That's an economic benefit that the president is giving to you as a company. It's not a legal right to participate in any administrative or legal proceedings. That's correct, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if you don't have a legal right to participate in proceedings, then why do you have a right to intervene?
Because even if we didn't have a legal right to participate, we believe that in that scenario, we would have a sort of a mirror APA standing to bring a claim if, for example, Commerce had rendered a determination and it had said, you know, we had submitted factual information establishing our ability to produce this, and Commerce said, no, we're going to allow this exclusion because no party submitted evidence. And you know, in this hypothetical, we had. So
you think you could have appealed from Commerce's decision to deny or to grant the exclusion request to the CIT?
Yes, if Commerce had done so on an arbitrary basis of some sort, I think the CIT statute giving it jurisdiction to review the administration of tariffs, and here we have a tariff program, we would have had a mere sort of APA claim to say, look, this was arbitrary because you didn't consider our evidence, and your decision says as much.
What in the regulation setting up this program, or there's certainly nothing in 232, right? What in the regulation setting up this program suggested that you would have the right to appeal?
So the regulations, they're explicit that they don't address the right to appeal for any party, for the
exclusion. And so where is your statutory authority to appeal?
So our statutory authority to appeal, we believe, would be grounded in the APA, just like these claims here.
Well, the APA doesn't grant jurisdiction. What's the jurisdiction for you to appeal to the CIT?
Oh, certainly. It would be 1581ID. It would be the...
What does that say?
Yes, Your Honor. It grants the Court of International Trade jurisdiction to hear claims concerning the administration or enforcement of tariffs, not for the purpose of raising revenue, which is the Section 232 tariffs are an example of that, Your Honor.
And you think that extends to parties that have no involvement with the payment of tariffs?
So, yes, Your Honor, we would say that that does, in this circumstance, because we are specifically identified as the intended beneficiary of these tariffs. So, therefore, because in the hypothetical where we're not identified as a beneficiary, you know, we're just sort of on the outside looking in. And that, you know, that situation, I understand. We're not, you know, we don't have a sort of a role to play there. But here, where we're specifically identified in the sort of proclamation creating these tariffs as the intended beneficiary, then we're sort of losing something if those tariffs are improperly administered, either arbitrarily or otherwise. And so on that basis, we think we would have, an injury to claim at the court, and therefore we'd be able to bring this to their attention.
You're into your rebuttal time. Would you like to save it?
Yes, Your Honor, if there's no further questions, I will.
Okay. Mr. Litvak?
May it please the court, my name is Sandy Litvak. I'm of the law firm of Chaffetz Lindsay. And today I'm representing all the plaintiff appellees on this appeal. We've answered in our brief all their arguments, and I'm going to stand on that. But I'd like today, if I may, with the court's permission, to just focus on two things that I think are dispositive. One is, what is the real interest as required by 24A? And two is that interest adequately protected? The answer to the second is yes, and I'll tell you what I think the answer to the first is. In the Court of International Trade, but unlike here, they said their interest was, and it is, an economic one. They've conjured up a scenario in which they could be adversely impacted economically. Okay, they said that. Now, that didn't work for a reason I'll tell you, and it doesn't work here.
I get you want to give your general argument. I'm curious about what your response to his last argument,
sure,
that under that tariff provision, under I, they would get to challenge this. I mean, that seems...
I believe the answer to that. Yeah, I think he misspoke or is in error. Let me put it that way.
I mean, this is...
Here's why.
Here's why
I think that's wrong. Yeah. What they would have to do is claim they're an aggrieved party under the APA. But to do that, they've got the same problem they've got here. You have to have a direct, immediate impact. And that's what they don't have. They're a bystander. They have a rooting interest, as we put it in our brief. Those are my words.
Well, let me interrupt you to make sure I have this straight. You say they're not an aggrieved party. However, injury was found to a domestic industry. That's them. So why are they not an aggrieved party?
Well, if the exclusion had been granted, which is the hypothetical under which the aggrieved party would ever arrive, if they had been granted, Commerce would have made a determination. It doesn't directly affect them. It's not saying they can't do something. It is just simply saying that the tariffs will not apply to these particular shipments. It might apply to others. It might be limited in quantity. We're talking about a hypothetical in which Commerce has made an industry-wide decision. They would not have any special standing.
No future imports could be covered by the exclusion, so any relief granted on this remand would not directly impact their economic interest, correct?
No, at this point, no, absolutely not. Certainly not directly.
Absolutely no. Are you disagreeing with me? I said no future imports could be covered by the exclusion. So on this remand,
I'm agreeing with you, yes. Yeah, I misheard. Yes, I misheard what you said. Yes. The key here, to come back to the question you asked, is...
If you don't have to pay tariffs, and Commerce says you don't have to pay tariffs because you've satisfied this, how does... Well, I guess you've said that doesn't directly impact them. That's what they would have to show to challenge that exclusion.
Precisely.
Not just generally, this might have some downstream impact on their business.
That's exactly the point. That is precisely the point. And it's precisely the problem here, too. Their argument is we might be economically impacted. You know, this is four square. Rarely you get one. Un-American merchant.
Maybe the government has an answer. You may know this, too, if you do this stuff. Isn't I just that I four or whatever provision he's talking about directed at people who have to pay tariffs? And that they can challenge it under I for some reason if it doesn't go through the other parts of either A or whatever.
I'm going to defer to the government on that.
I'm not particularly familiar with that specific subpart of I either, but it seems to me that it relates to people who have been told they have to pay tariffs or at a higher rate than they think they should, not at an industry that is protected by those tariffs.
I'm not an expert on it, but yes. It's direct. Look, the tariff is a penalty. And again, as I say, it comes back to American merchant marine. It's exactly the same situation there that this court looked at. There, Aeron objected to one of its competitors getting a subsidy. This is the flip side. This is the tariff being imposed. Instead of the subsidy, it's the tariff. In both cases, American and here, the objecting party, the competitor, is saying, hey, look, that might hurt me. I may lose sales in this case, or I may lose profits in this case. And what the court said, and rightly so, is that's not enough. It's got to be direct and immediate. And that's what Judge Baker said. He had it absolutely right. Now, I think, obviously, which is the reason for the lawsuit, that Commerce got it wrong. But that's what the judge is going to decide. I want to comment on something said that you focused upon it, which is the record. The record that is before the court, first of all, they can tell the court whatever they want as amicus. He's not going to preclude them. Indeed, he keeps inviting them to file amicus papers if they like. Secondly, beyond that, the fact is the record is what the Commerce Department looked at and decided upon. The record is set. It's not what they like. It's not what they think. It's what did Commerce do.
And the reason... they can see all non-confidential parts of this record, right?
Yeah.
Or is the entire record designated as confidential?
The record is... No. The entire record is not confidential. Portions of it are confidential. And they've designated some of their stuff as confidential. But the question at the end of the day is what did Commerce rely upon? And by the way, when Commerce asked for a voluntary remand, they cited Judge Kelly's decision in a JSW case in which I was involved because what Judge Kelly said, and the reason they've asked for the remand, is she said, you, Commerce, have never explained how you got to this decision. It wasn't a question about is it a right or wrong. She never got to that. She was just saying, there's nothing before me that I can decipher as to why or how you got there. So she sent it back. Commerce, or the Department of Justice, now looks at it and says, well, you know, maybe there's some merit to that. Maybe we better go back, look at it again, maybe come to the same decision, but write a better decision, or maybe come to a different decision and decide that the plaintiffs are right. All that abides. All of that further suggests the last point I want to make within my remaining 3 minutes, which is this, like Wolfson, is a case where it is perfectly clear the government's interests and their interests are totally aligned. They both want the Commerce decision to be upheld. It's just that simple. They have different motives. The government wants it upheld because it believes it was correct and in accordance with the APA. They want it upheld, maybe for that, but more importantly, because they think they have an economic interest. But the end result is the same. Their interests are perfectly aligned, and that leads me in my last 2 minutes to one point. The reason they want it, and you ask, well, why wouldn't amicus satisfy you? I don't want to attribute bad motives, but the thing is clear. They don't like the fact that we settled. They don't like the fact that we've gotten back some tariff money. Now, put aside the fact that that doesn't impact them. They don't want it. But the fact that they don't want it isn't sufficient to grant intervention. Settlements are a good thing, not a bad thing. The government has looked at its case. The plaintiffs have looked at its case. And each side has decided, you know what? We better not risk the court decision. Let's resolve it. They want to get in the middle of that.
Can I just ask you, even if they were allowed to intervene, could they stop the government from settling?
No, they can't stop them, but if you excuse the vernacular, they can muck up the process.
Sure.
And that's what they would do. Because short of that, what's the difference? Why do they want in? If they can't
anything. I understand that, but they can muck up the process now if they want to. It doesn't have to be through the court proceeding. They can raise it through the political people at Commerce, and you'll complain to them that this exclusion, you shouldn't have granted it, right?
Yeah, they can do that, but the Department of Justice is involved, and the Department of Justice is making the decisions, and they're making the decisions based upon their assessment of the merits of the lawsuit.
Sure,
I'm comfortable with them making that decision.
Sure, but they're going to listen to Commerce if they talk.
Of course they are. It's their client.
The whole place goes, I mean,
it's their client. Of course they're going to listen. But at the end of the day,
there's no way that Commerce is going to shut out the domestic industry if they want to be heard.
They will be heard. There's a process to be heard. I've spent enough time at the Department of Justice to have confidence. They will make a judgment based on the merits. They will decide whether the risk of losing the lawsuit is sufficiently great that they ought to settle with us. They have decided that in a variety of cases. And by the way, there's a variety of cases where they haven't decided that. They haven't settled it for whatever reason. CSI is one of them. But I've also settled for JSW and other clients. So the government looks at the merits. Their interests are absolutely protected by the United States. They're legitimate interests. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Litvak. Ms. Motto?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ann Motto on behalf of the United States. I will just address a few issues so as not to be repetitive with my colleague, Mr. Litvak. We do agree that the interveners have not shown that for the proposed...
Before you get on to what you really want to talk about, can you just answer this? Or I know it's a late term question and you may not know, but is this subpart of I something that even conceivably applies to the domestic, this specific part of the domestic industry here?
No. So Section 1581 in general is just a jurisdictional statute. It does not, you know, supply a cause of action. 1581I is a residual grant of jurisdiction that if A through H doesn't cover it, I is kind of that catch-all provision. Here, the substantive cause of action under I is the APA. The APA governs the claims in I cases. Here, the proposed interveners don't have an APA claim because they were successful before Commerce, so they don't have an APA claim. So that would
not...
Do
you think they could have filed an APA claim if they were not successful?
Well,
these people, if you had given them the exclusion at Commerce to the people seeking it, and they weren't, I'm a little confused because it doesn't sound like they're actually an official party to the administrative proceeding. They're just allowed to comment. But either way, do you think that they could file an APA challenge to Commerce's exclusion decision? If Commerce granted the relief accepted under that I provision?
I don't think so. I think they would have a standing issue because, again, I don't think, you know, when we're looking at intervention, for example, we're looking to see on whether, you know, well, they'd have a standing issue because if the exclusion requests were granted and then the, because we're talking about if it was granted, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they were granted and they were allowed to import those products, even if they sued, they would still, again, they'd have a problem showing that a judgment in this case would directly impact them because all that would, again, it would affect the pockets of
the
other
party. We don't have to decide any of this because they won't.
Correct.
Okay.
But I do think in that situation they'd have a hard time, again, showing. Yes. And just to address Your Honor's questions about Section 232, Section B2 of the statute only says, if appropriate, that the Secretary of Commerce may hear from the domestic industry. And the proclamation, as my colleague talked about, it doesn't talk about them at all. So there is no right for them to be here. They do have a right to object before commerce. But here, win, lose, settle, they cannot show that they will be directly impacted by a judgment of this court for the reasons stated by my colleague. And if your honors don't have any other questions from me, I'm happy to give Mr. Litvak the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Ransdell, you have some rebuttal time left.
Thank you, Your Honors. So if I may refocus a little bit back to Rule 24A, even if it were impossible for us to appeal in an alternative sort of hypothetical situation, we can intervene as defendant here because we had a regulatory right to offer factual information administratively. Commerce relied on that information in making its decisions, and we satisfy the criteria of the rule for intervention. And the practical fact is the potential for future or sort of forward-looking relief, if it was ever in doubt, is established by the settlements in Interpipe and the many other settlements that our friends on the other side mentioned. And moreover, the administrative determinations here themselves have value to us as a regulatory factor that Commerce considers in making these exclusion determinations in the future. So we have, if I can sort of put it crudely, an ace in the hole that we can point to with respect to any future exclusion requests for these products. And if plaintiffs are successful, there's a possibility. And again, Rule 24 is only looking for a possibility. The word is may. And so it doesn't need to be definite, but there's a possibility that that gets taken out from under us. And so we go from having an ace in the hole to the deck being stacked against us. And so there is a real risk of practical impairment on a going forward basis. And the question, again, of the adequacy of protection, the final prong of the rule, we think is answered by the existence of the settlements and sort of by the just the sheer volume of administrative records at issue here. I mean, the plaintiffs themselves, they moved to quote-unquote complete the record because they thought that what the government provided to the court was incomplete. So when we're dealing with 800 records out of hundreds of thousands, the potential that something might be missing, that's something that, you know, we would be able to point to as supporting the government's original decision-making is a real practical potential. This is not a tort case like in Wolfson where the government's just protecting the Treasury money. This is a case where Commerce Department is a neutral decision maker sort of administering a statute. And it's got to make judgment calls about, you know, what specifically the terms set out in the proclamation mean, whether there's a quantity and quality, like what are those requirements? And we may look at them one way, Commerce may look at them the other way, and we may have ways of reading our evidence that we provided administratively that establishes that whatever standards Commerce settles upon were met. And if we are allowed to participate in this process, we can point to the administrative record that is before the court and say, look, Commerce, here's where it is. Like, you don't need to settle these cases. You were right all along, and here's the support. And just a last point.
But you're not even allowed to do that at the administrative process. You might have a better argument if Commerce had and its regulations had given you a right to be a party at the administrative process and comment on the record and the like, but you can't do any of that, right? You don't get to see everything everybody else submitted. You just get to offer your own comments.
Well, yes. Well,
you're asking for more rights at the CIT than you have at Commerce.
No, Your Honor. I would respectfully disagree because we are simply seeking to explain our evidence that we provided administratively, and that is we have full possibility to do so.
You still can do that.
Well, Your Honor, we don't know what the Department of Justice is looking at and
right.
What discussions.
You want to look at the record, which you don't have a right to do at Commerce.
But we have a right to look at the record that would support Commerce's denial of these exclusions, and that is something that we don't know whether that is complete before the Court of International Trade.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission. This concludes our proceedings for today.